Monday, January 17, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. A week after the shootings in Tucson, Americans were glad to hear that Representative Gabrielle Giffords has improved, her condition raised from critical to serious. This took place, of course, even as some of the last funerals are taking place for the six who were killed in the assassination attempt upon Representative Giffords. But the nation was also embroiled in a very intense controversy over the meaning of these events. There will be some reckoning in terms of the media and political response to this. But for now, the good news concerning Representative Giffords' condition is enough for comment today. By the way, according to news reports, less than 10% of those who are shot in the head and suffer a brain injury from a bullet actually live. We will all hope and pray that Representative Giffords will be in that blessed minority. The big news on the international scene over the weekend came from Tunisia, North Africa, where strongman President Ben Ali fled the country to Saudi Arabia after a coup removed him. It was popular pressure because rioters and insurrectionists had gone into the streets, and by the time Ben Ali fled the country, it was clear that the regime had lost control. Now, the interesting thing about this particular story over the weekend is that the government of this dictatorial president was replaced by a government which appears to be very little government at all. As a matter of fact, the rioting continued and the insurrection appeared to go on unabated because, after all, what we face here is the reality that every single people, every single country, every governing state requires a functioning government. And that is the case in Tunisia now. International analysts had hoped that at least by this morning there would be some news of a stable government out of Tunis, but at this point it appears that instability rules. Now, from a Christian worldview, there are a couple of things to note here. First of all, we are on the side of those who support human rights and who believe the human rights are translated and translated best into a representative form of government. At the same time, we understand also that there is a function of government that must be fulfilled, whatever its form, which is to say that there is more danger from no government than from a bad government. Now, there may be a case in which, of course, this kind of anarchy is a transition to something better, but what we see in Tunisia right now reminds us that every single society needs a functioning government, and without that functioning government, there is no restraint upon the passions of a people. Where there is no respect for law and no rightful legal authority, well, what you see is a breakdown of all order from the top to the bottom of a society. Now, one of the interesting things going on here has to do with the legacy of colonialism. Tunisia was long time related to France as a colonial power, but we need to note that Tunisia, in terms of the war on terror, has been a close friend of the United States. It has been a country that has lacked the kind of Muslim extremism that has marked so many countries in the region. We need to hope and pray that that will continue. What we face in this is also another sign that there are changes afoot in the world scene, and that as time rolls on, dictators appear to be fewer and fewer. That may explain why something interesting is going on in China. China, of course, is still a dictatorship ruled by the Communist Party and its governing elite, but it is trying a mixture of market capitalism and, well, what we see is a very strange amalgam that is right now uniquely Chinese. But the Chinese have done something interesting in recent weeks. They have placed a major statue of Confucius in Tiananmen Square right alongside the statue of Chairman Mao. Now, the historical significance of this is pretty weighty because Chairman Mao himself had established a rule that was to eradicate Confucianism from the Chinese mind. He actually declared a cultural war on Confucius. Well, now Confucius is back. You ask why? Well, it is because the Chinese authorities, dictators though they may be, recognize that their society needs a deep cultural basis, and that means going back to a culture that is much older than the Chinese Communist Revolution of the 1940s. So, what we see now in Tiananmen Square is an acknowledgement that worldview matters, that culture is important, and that, after all, communism doesn't have the cultural rootage to support the kind of cultural and national ambitions that China now represents. The statue of Confucius there in Tiananmen Square is, whether the Chinese authorities recognize it or not, not only a reminder of the Eastern worldview so shaped by Confucius himself, but a reminder of the failure of communism that now has to bring back Confucius just to prop up the regime. Today marks Martin Luther King Day in the United States. And in anticipation of the day, USA Today had a very interesting column by Sharon Shaheed asking the question, what if Martin Luther King had tweeted his letter from the Birmingham jail? That letter goes back to 1963 when King was arrested. And on a roll of toilet paper, with a smuggled ballpoint pen, he wrote one of the most moving pieces of prison literature in American history. He called out for the religious leaders of Birmingham, in particular the Christian leaders, to join his effort to demand human rights for all persons in what became known as the Civil Rights Movement. Now, what Sharon Shaheed writes with very keen insight is the fact that what was required at that time was a letter, a written document. It was published not only in letter form, but it was published in book form and had a tremendous impact in terms of building momentum for the Civil Rights Movement. We now live in a world of tweets and text messages. But one of the points Sharon Shaheed makes in this column is that there are some messages that can't be reduced to 140 characters or to a text message. She writes this, "Nevertheless, there is something to be said about powerful words written by old-fashioned pen on toilet paper." She continued, "A text message just wouldn't have the same ring of desperation to it as sentences in the margins of newsprint. King's voice, so poignant and crystal clear in print, simply would lose resonance in cyber ink." End quote. These different modes of communication and the digital revolution have their place, but we need to remember that there is still no replacement for the words most meaningful that end up on paper and ink. One of the most famous speeches in American history was offered 50 years ago today. Outgoing President Dwight David Eisenhower spoke to the nation for the last time as its president. In his address, given 50 years ago today, he warned of the emergence of what he called the military-industrial complex. President Eisenhower suggested that every single bomber represented money taken away from causes like education and feeding the poor. Nevertheless, here we have the last five-star general in American history and the last general to be elected president of the United States, the hero of D-Day and the victory of the Allied forces in Europe, who was warning about the military-industrial combination. He called it a complex, and he suggested that it would feed on itself and eventually feed on the rest of the country. Now, one of the interesting things that I want to bring out about this particular address is that no one at the time thought that this point was President Eisenhower's main point. James Ledbetter, in his new book entitled Unwarranted Influence, Dwight David Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex, suggests that what happened after the address was, well, very little in terms of the recognition of much that was historic. As a matter of fact, the American attention was almost immediately riveted on the next major speech given in terms of American history 50 years ago also in coming days. That address, of course, was the inaugural address of President John F. Kennedy. Now, when we think about this particular point, we need to recognize that speeches sometimes take on a life of their own. We also understand that later causes and those who lead them may go back to previous speeches and take them out of historical context. To some degree, that's what happened as America soured on the war in Vietnam and as anti-war sentiment looked back to President Eisenhower, who, after all, really got the whole Vietnam experiment started, and found that particular phrase in his farewell address and latched upon it. No doubt, the military-industrial complex is a very powerful combination of words. It has led to many other kinds of complexes that have become hyphenated in the American imagination. It is now impossible to know exactly what President Eisenhower would want remembered from that address, but it's unlikely that that particular point was his main point. Nevertheless, it is so in the American memory 50 years later. Over the weekend, the Roman Catholic Church welcomed the first Anglicans who converted to become Roman Catholic priests under the special arrangement announced by Pope Benedict XVI just last year. Three traditionalist Anglican bishops converted from being Anglican bishops to being Roman Catholic priests. Does this mean that the floodgates are now open for other Roman Catholic priests to emerge from within the Anglican Communion? Well, time will tell. But it is unlikely that there will be large numbers. But, you know, you have to ask the question, at what point does the tripwire all of a sudden lead some of these Anglicans to decide to jump? And how they make the decision to jump to the Roman Catholic Church? Well, Well, let's be reminded that the Anglican Communion was, in many ways, halfway reformed. The Anglo-Catholic wing has been very close to the Roman Catholic Church in terms of tradition and liturgy and theology. And so these traditionalist Anglicans coming from the Anglo-Catholic wing didn't have far to go home to Rome. It was another story, however, published in the New York Times over the weekend that caught my attention and will likely catch the attention of other evangelicals as well. Rachel Donadio, reporting for the New York Times, offers this headline, John Paul II to be beatified in the spring. Now, the process of beatification is one of the last major steps towards sainthood, and John Paul II, the late pope, is certainly on the fast track to be declared a saint. Now, one of the things necessary for this, of course, is that the late pope would be credited with a miracle, and now there is a nun claiming that she was cured of Parkinson's disease after she prayed to John Paul II after his death. This business of praying to the saints is one of the major dividing points between evangelical Protestants and Roman Catholics. A statement published in this New York Times article draws this distinction into very clear relief. The Archbishop of Warsaw in Poland is credited with saying, I remember kneeling beside his open coffin in St. Peter's Basilica. It never even crossed my mind to pray for him. I've always prayed directly to him. I've always known he is a saint. End quote. The whole idea of praying to saints is an absolute rejection of what we find in the New Testament pattern of prayer, and especially as Jesus Christ himself taught us to pray in the Lord's Prayer. There's absolutely no biblical basis whatsoever for addressing prayers to saints, believing that saints have some power of intercession. That comment, published in the New York Times, coming from a man who is none other than the Archbishop of Warsaw, tells us just how central the veneration of saints remains in Roman Catholicism. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.